I guess just start thanking the organizers for putting on this conference, and first of all, foremost inviting me, because I've actually never worked on the path integral of gravity, and so I was in a little bit of trouble to think of a good talk. But eventually I thought I had gonna say something about I've done with my student Giovanni Collini. About an approach to quantization that is originally due to Fedosov, and we were trying to think about how to, you know, what that would tell you in the context of field theories, like a scalar field. But also, it turns out there's a nice story for gravity. So this is basically based on a talk I gave some years ago, and then Giovanni worked out all the details and a lot more in his PhD thesis. So let me first say something. So now I guess you can raise this after you've taken a good glance at the slide. So there is something I wanted to say is how to do Poisson brackets without introducing a space-time split. And this is a very old thing. It's due to Pyrles, who came up with this in 1952. And it's a very pretty idea, very simple too. And so I'll explain it in a non-gravitational context where you have maybe an action of just a scalar field. So this is, and then, maybe some potential here. So everything is Lorentzian. So that's important. So usually, you know, Poisson brackets, you fix a time slice or a Cauchy surface. But there is a way to do it without. And this goes as follows. So this, in general, is a nonlinear field equation, of course. But you can consider it's the linearization. So suppose you have a solution. So stay. Called also stationary point, or anyway, it's some background solution. And now you study the linearized equation. So the U is an infinitesimal solution, and I guess it's maybe 1/2 here. Then that it would be V double primed of your background times U equal to 0. So this is your background. It survives when this is higher than quadratic. And so this U is a linearized perturbation around this solution. So the new solution is something like U plus something like this. And so now this is just a linear equation. And when you have a linear wave equation, so this is the wave operator or D'Alembertian operator. Then you have something called the advanced and retarded fundamental solutions. So what they are, they depend on your background here, because that's in your equation. And then they depend on x and y. And they're Green's functions for this linear equation with a boundary condition that the advanced propagator is non-zero only if the second point is in the future of the other, and the retarded is the time reversal of this. So this you always have. And then you can form the difference. The advanced minus the retarded. And that's not a Green's function. It's actually a solution to the homogeneous equation. That's called delta. That's also called the causal propagator. So now I'm ready to give you the Poisson bracket without, or Pyrles bracket, as it's called, without a space-time split. It's very easy. Space. So I have, let's say I have some functionals of your field. So observables are just functionals of the field configuration. Let's say the functional could be evaluate the field at point x, or evaluate the square of field at point x, or integrate phi over space time or something. These are my observables. So the action is one such observables, there are tons more. So what you want to define is the bracket between two such guys. So one is f, one is g. So this should again be a functional of your solutions. And what it simply is you take the double integral of df by phi x, and then you take the causal propagator, which depends on your background and x and y, and then you take dg del phi x phi y. So this is a bracket. It's anti-symmetric simply because this is an anti-symmetric combination. If you swap x and y, then you swap the role of future and past, so you swap what advanced and retarded is. So it's anti-symmetric, what you always want from a Poisson bracket. And it's very easy to show that it also satisfies the Jacobi identities. So that's the Pyrrhus bracket. Now, I guess you can, at some point, I'll need it.
Question.
Yes.
The way you started out, the phi in the property,
yes,
is a solution.
Yeah, it's a background solution. So you take a background, so your favorite background solution, so could be zero. Yeah, that would be fine.
So now, in the bracket, delta depends on the solution.
Yes.
Do you mean that the whole bracket is evaluated at the solution?
Yeah, it is evaluated at the solution. This is
evaluated also
there. The so this is a new thing, which obviously is going to depend on phi. Okay. So that's, you can check that if you want the connection to the ordinary Poisson bracket, is very easy. So you just say, okay, a solution, I can parameterize my solutions by their initial data. So that's a pair of the field and its first time derivative. And then if I want, I can express everything in terms of these data without solving any field equations. And then I get the usual Poisson bracket, as everyone writes. But this is a nice version which does not need a space-time split. So now we want to quantize this. So by the way, you can also do, since this is all about gravity, there's no difficulty at all to generalize this to gravity, as long as you stick to diffeomorphism invariant observables, as I'll explain. So now, what's deformation quantization? So you want it. So the usual viewpoint of quantization is you either do your path integral, but I'll come to the path integral later. So this will more appear as an afterthought. But the other viewpoint is the operator viewpoint, where you say, okay, I'm going to promote my classical observables to operators on some Hilbert space, and then this leading order should become my commutator. So deformation quantization is just a fancy math version of this, but there is a twist of this. So when you do the usual thing, there is the ordering problem where, you know, if you have a P, P's and Q's, you know, where do I put the P and where do I put the Q? So in deformation quantization, you say something different. You say, well, rather than tinkering with my making these operators, what I'm going to deform, what I'm going to introduce is the product, the quantum product between these things. And that's called, in this, I didn't invent this, it's called the star product. And so what the star product is, so you say you don't, your things are just your classical observables, but you're going to introduce a product, an associative product. And what you say is that if you have an f and a g, then this should be f times g. That's the ordinary product of classical observables, and nothing quantum about this. And then that should be plus some order h bar correction. That's kind of what you want, obviously. And then if you have an antisymmetric combination like so, then you want this to be I h bar times this Pyrrhus bracket. And then you want that to be corrected by order h squared. So you need the higher order terms, for otherwise this is never going to be an associative product. So you may ask, where did this ordering ambiguity disappear? Because it's got to be somewhere. And that disappeared. It didn't disappear. It just is hidden in the fact that there were many such kind of products. You've just, in a way, shifted this. But it's, from a mathematical viewpoint, a better way to look at it. So you can ask just for, so this is field theory, but you can ask a similar question for just a finite dimensional system, where you have a symplectic structure. I guess a physicist also knows symplectic structure. And you may ask whether this problem always has a solution. And mathematicians naturally wondered about that question and whether to what extent it's unique. And there was a particularly nice solution given by a Russian mathematician, Fedosov, in 94. So there were some tries and some sort of semi-incorrect papers, but he really nailed it. Actually, I should mention there's also a famous Zadkovich that was like this in 2002 or something. That's a bit more general, but we'll do with this one. So Vedotov had this beautiful geometric way to do this. But before I explain it, let me just do, just as an example, the free scalar field, because everyone should be able to do the free scalar field, or which is the analog of the harmonic oscillator. So that's the case where V of phi is, let's say, 1/2 m squared phi squared. So how do you do it in this way? So what you need is the following. You need a Green's, you need a, so what I call Weidman function. So this is something, W of x and y, and its imaginary part. So this can be written as I times this delta, and then there is a real part g. And so for on Minkowski space, this is nothing but the, I haven't really talked about Hilbert spaces, but what it basically is phi of x, phi of y, and g is the symmetric part, and delta is the anti-symmetric part. And then the... Oh, yeah, maybe there are lots of halves, but at least no i's.
No, just a half. I delta over 2.
Yeah, I think it's a half. Right. And then let's put the 1/2 over 2. Okay, so how does it, how is this, what is the star product? Is F tensor F star G? Is it, you do it like this. You take F, and then you take the exponential here of integral x and y and dx.
This is also called the Feynman propagator.
No, it's not called, there's lots of propagators in from field theory, confusingly many. So this is called the causal propagator by Count. So I figured Stückelberg had a really interesting name, and I just Googled it. So where is it? No, it's. So this delta is the causal propagator, but what Stückelberg in his real name was Ernst Karl Gerlach Stückelberg von Breitenbach zu Breitenstein bei Auf Marlborg. So he had a really long name, I couldn't remember it. But so this is, there is nothing time ordered here at all. So this is the non-time ordered thing. And so the this is the what is called the commutator function. It's the same delta I wrote there. And this is just the symmetric part which specifies the state. So let me just do this.
Is the final propagator.
No, the time ordered is the Feynman propagator. Okay, so all you do is you take this complicated looking thing. So this would be f times g, the leading order, and then it's still And then there's, I guess, an h bar here. So you generate all these things, and you realize if you take an anti-symmetric combination, then that corresponds to the anti-symmetric part of the W. But the anti-symmetric part of the W is this. So you get what you want. But there are all these higher order directions. So this is basically what the star product is. But so the star product depends on this. And this depends, in general, on the state that you put here. So this is completely unique, but this isn't. And here is where the ambiguity is. OK, so that's a free scalar field. But the idea, though, this corresponds to the usual constant symplectic structure. But what these mathematicians were interested in, not in the field theory context, but in the final finite dimensional context, was the case when the symplectic manifold is curved. And so the beautiful idea was this. So it's geometrical. So the beautiful idea was this. So let's call S the saddle points, or the classical solutions, or whatever you want to call it. So in the finite dimensional case, it's just P and Q, because that's your initial data. So it's the phase space, if you like. So we think of it, though, as solution. That's a sort of covariant way to look at the phase space. And so you think of S as a manifold. And then this S, the functionals, I mean, I'm just telling you complete trivialities here. So these are your classical solutions here. And the functionals are just things that give you a value for each classical solution. So they're just I'm drawing fancy fibers, but it's just giving you a complex number for each solution. And so depending on which solution, you're going to get a different number here. And now you say, OK, now what is this thing here, this W? Let's do it in the finite dimensional analog case. So you know probably this Bryce-DeWitt notation, where a space-time point is like a continuous index and this kind of thing. So this would be like the continuous index of I times the symplectic form, the sigma ij, so the anti-symmetric matrix. And this is a new thing. This is just a Riemannian metric, this thing here. Why is it a Riemannian metric? Well, first, it's symmetric. And then for a state from Hilbert space positivity, it's positive definite. So what you have on this manifold here in the classical case, this carries structure. It carries the sigma. I'm writing now a switching between the finite dimensional and the infinite dimensional case. And it carries a metric here, a G, a Riemannian metric. So this is, maybe I should call it capital G. It has nothing to do whatsoever with the space-time metric. It's a metric on field space. And so the condition for a state means basically that if I take this sigma ij and I raise an index, so I get a sigma ij upstairs, then this should square to minus 1. So it's like an almost Taylor space. So what you have, what this S is an almost Taylor space. So that's just from the postulate of quantum mechanics. And then what Fedosov says is, OK, now rather than, so I want, to, I have, I have, to, I, so in this linear theory, this is just a linear vector space. So there's nothing. And these are just the cons. So you see, this doesn't depend on the background anymore. Because if I do a second derivative of V, the background dependence is gone. But if I have a non-free field, like a phi to phi cubed or phi 4, then this depends on the background. So this, in general, will be a curved almost Kähler space, a curved in the sense of curved on field space. So back my space-time, maybe still Minkowski space, so I'm talking about field space here. And so so this curved manifold here has a connection.
Sorry, what is the pair you've written down?
So the pair is just I'm giving you in each tangent space here this W. So for free field, it doesn't So in each tangent space, I now am giving you this two-point function. So it's a two-point function for a linearized scalar field around your background. So that's a trivial theory. And I give you a state, and that defines a two-point function, and I'm free to decompose it into its symmetric and anti-symmetric part, or real and imaginary part is the same. And I'm going to just geometrically reinterpret this as a metric on field space, and I'm going to interpret this as a skew tensor on field space. And so I have two. So this is maybe I should call this delta. And so you have a connection here, like the Levi-Civita connection. You can do the same thing. So you could get a connection which is compatible with G. Everyone knows this from GR textbook. But there's also a connection which additionally is compatible with an anti-symmetric thing. So this is the Christoffel symbol has some extra terms here coming from this. So this is this thing. And what Fedosov says, so here is the prescription for this star product. So rather than taking the fibers here to be C, he says, well, let's take these fibers at each field, background field configuration to be the Wick polynomials or the quantum operators for this free field, for this linearized free theory. So that's a trivial theory. So rather than having the F here be a number, I just have it to be an operator here. So you put an F hat here. Yeah, so it's just, okay. So how does he find this operator? The construction is not at all trivial, but the crux is the following. So how am I going to find this operator? So the idea is I have a connection. And wouldn't it be nice to just choose this thing here, choose this operator to be a section which is flat with respect to this connection? So the idea by Fedosov is to say, well, I'm going to assign this quantum operator to F in such a way that D, his connection, on F is 0. Well, that's not a good definition, as it turns out, because this is not a flat covariant derivative, because this is a curved manifold. So this manifold of field configuration has curvature. So it's not a good idea to use this connection. So Fedosov says, I'm going to make this a flat connection. By taking this Levi-Civita thing, D, and I'm going to add some inhomogeneous term, just like a vector potential or something. But this is now a vector potential on field space. It's nothing to do with a gauge potential on Minkowski space. And so what this thing is a series in H bar involving the Riemann curvature tensor and its powers of this almost scalar thing. So, and it's possible many derivatives of it. And the derivatives here of the J of this delta here. And so he has a prescription for producing canonically, there's no freedom, canonically a flat connection. And then he says, my quantum observables are not these C numbers over every point, which are the classical values of this thing, but it's a supposed an associated flat section here. So that's the key thing. So he, rather than saying, so the convention, so because this is a series in H bar, it's a perturbation series. Yeah. So you generate a whole big perturbation series. So the conventional viewpoint on perturbation theory is you fix your background like usually zero. And then you generate your perturbative corrections. But he is saying differently, rather than doing that, I investigate how the perturbation series at different backgrounds would be related to each other. And he says they're related to each other in precisely such a way that when you move in the direction of this flat covariant derivative, that is constant. So the whole issue is to find this Fedosov connection. So now, so how much time do I have?
Minus 12. 5 minutes?
Okay, so how about gravity? So this is for a scalar field, but of course I understand you're all interested in gravity. So in gravity, of course, I just have to take my action and perhaps add some terms. So now I'm a bit intimidated by the previous talks and I feel shy to just add this one, but I'll do it nevertheless. And then maybe add a Gibbons Hawking term if I happen to have a boundary. Okay, but it's still an action. It's still got classical solutions. I still have linearized solutions. It's now just a linearized Einstein's matter equations, but who cares? It's just linear. So everything is completely fine. The only thing I have to be concerned about is that this is not going to be really well defined because you need to go to some gauges and so on. So you want it to be independent. So you want to define it for gauge invariant observables. So now gauge invariant observables are a big pain in the neck, usually in gravity, but I claim it's completely trivial to write them down. So you can say you introduce some fields which are coordinate vectors, coordinate fields. So introduce four dimensions, four fields, which I'm going to say are my coordinates, but they're dynamical fields. They're not externally given. And then a gauge invariant observable would be just a random, completely random one. So just I define my observable to be the area of the sphere where defined by the condition that it's a sphere of radius r defined as an equipotential sphere of this field phi. And it's obvious, I claim this is going to be gauge invariant observable. It's obvious. So of course this has to satisfy some non-degeneracy condition. But in principle, it's trivial to write down such gauge invariant. So this just is a random example here. Now, you can do this for gravity. And now I want to come to the connection with the path integral. So this.
So are you claiming that's gauge that's diffeo invariant?
Yeah, obvious, I think. Well, if I move the points, then I also, this is the equipotential surface of some field. So if I move the points, I move the metric, and I move this field, I don't care at what coordinate values I assign to this equipotential surface.
You're assuming you're in some particular state of that collection of fields?
Yeah, well, my observables are functionals of the classical function. So that's the beauty of this thing. Yeah? So it would be difficult to write down such things if you used a canonical formalism. But I claim it's basically trivial to write. I mean, it's been noted by many people before. OK, so now what's the connection with the path integral? So I want to, so I claim that, and this my student Giovanni has worked out. So this looks very abstract, and Fedosov had nothing. He didn't have in mind quantum field theory or anything. But the crux is this series that you get by demanding this flatness turns out to be equivalent to the perturbation series for the interacting quantum fields, as usually done with Feynman diagrams and so on. So the propagators in the Feynman diagrams would now be the time ordered W. So the time ordered thing of this. So I believe this is a beautiful viewpoint. So now the formal connection to the gravitational path integral is this. I don't just want these observables. I want to calculate something like expectation values or numbers. And so what I need to do, according to this prescription, I need to define in each fiber a state of the linearized theory. So this is my Kähler structure. And then this an observable a quantum expectation value. It turns out it is formally given by Nell. Allow me to use a notation. So I don't have to write this out. So let me, allow me to use this letter, capital phi, for both the gravitational field and any matter fields. So this is like a path integral, but it's not a path integral over all field configurations, but just the solutions, just an integration over the stationary or the saddle points. And then you have this, this thing that's coming from the Fedosov instruction, which is evaluated at the in the state in each fiber, and then you can weight it with e. You have to weight it with e to the s of the classical solution over h bar. So I claim this is like equivalent to the path integral. So the path integral usually is an integral over all field configurations, not just classicals, not just the saddle points. But what this does, this is from the saddle point. And these are all the h-bar correction from the fluctuations. So this is how it organizes. So what it makes clear is that there's this choice of state implied here. Yeah? So the usual path integral, that's maybe not so transparent. And you can just choose, if you so want, you can choose an f which is supported classically only on certain classical configurations. Yeah? So that's it's not a problem. So you can you can also go to do an analytic continuation in field space, and then you get to something that maybe other people will talk about some complexified space of solutions. And then here maybe some intersection number. Let's see. And then here you can write it. So this is e to the is phi over the complexified thing. So this has the advantage then that you can also work with complex saddles, and this is some intersection number, I guess, that will be explained. Okay, so but I want to emphasize that to go from here to here, you must choose a family of states on the classical solutions that varies analytically with your classical solution. And that in general is very difficult to get. So I think I'm going to stop here, and I hopefully have explained how this principle works.
So, to which theory you want to apply this kind of quantization? Scalar field?
Einstein scalar?
Einstein. But if you take normal quantum field theory,
yeah.
Okay, like electrodynamics or also.
Yeah, then you just, then in principle you reproduce some standard perturbation series. Yeah.
You mean that replacing the definition of the path integral?
Yeah, well then you get, then this is just really the scalar field here.
Oh, okay, let's take scalar.
So what is the advantage of this is you can have, usually you if you have used background method, usually you take one background and you quantize fluctuations right around one background. And here you consistently quantize around many backgrounds, and you can have a state which is sort of a superposition of different classical backgrounds together with the quantum fluctuation. That's the advantage.
In this case, you're not reproducing, for instance, electrodynamics on Minkowski space with all its corrections, because you are not changing backgrounds, because if in electrodynamics you would use this, you would consider different classical backgrounds.
Yes.
And then what you would get from your path integral is superposition of the result calculated using perturbation theory over many classical backgrounds.
That's correct, yes.
But okay, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I claim it does.
No, actually, for which quantities?
Well, you can.
You see, it's the same thing as to take and average the things over cat Schrödinger state, you see? Schrödinger cat state.
Yeah. Well, these are not.
Doesn't make any sense.
These are not. Nobody claims these are pure state. I mean, I guess for Schrödinger cat, you want to superpose pure states. These are not going to be in general superpositions of pure states.
No, it's in general.
So if you take a non-trivial background, then you have this background bath with all these photons is never going
right,
to be a
Schrödinger
state.
Schrödinger cat is analog. Dead Schrödinger cat is analog of one of your backgrounds. A live Schrödinger cat is analog of the other background.
So,
and then you make small perturbation theory. But if you would take an average over the full state, you would not get any reasonable expectation value.
Well, I claim you do. I mean, this has all the formal properties you want from an expectation value f of Dagger.
For observations, you see, for observations.
Well, I mean, I can produce many exotic states which are very unlike what we have here in this room. So that you don't say for this reason that quantum field theory is unreasonable.
Position of this table in two different positions.
Yes. Yes.
You cannot.
Such a state exists in the Hilbert space. No
Hilbert
problem.
Space
no problem. It exists. It's an experimental challenge to produce it.
Maybe the question is, what's the relation between that W subscript you have there and some quantum state? Presumably, it's playing the role. It's parameterizing the quantum state. Right?
Exactly. So you have
so
many
the
quantum states.
Have you produced a Hilbert space in quantum states, and which one among them would look like the one Slava wants? So,
well,
first of all, is that the question?
Well,
and second of all,
well, there is no. I mean, you can
it,
all.
So,
yeah.
Is it correct to say? I mean, what is your space of state? Is it correct to say?
Well, the space of
quantum. Let me just ask the question. Is it correct to say that the space of states is essentially a choice of a state of a linearized quantum theory about each background?
Yeah, with a consistency condition, how the state is supposed to vary. So the state is supposed to vary, be flat. You know, you have a state over each background. So for each background, you have a state. And there is a consistency condition, how it is supposed to vary.
So you choose only one, and the rest are determined?
Not completely.
No,
but it limits it, but doesn't.
Yeah, it limits it. Yes, that's right.
Okay. So it's a self-consistent choice of states for linearized gravity, linearized scalar fields.
Yeah, that is one possible view.
Classical
solution. Yeah, that's one possible view.
Yeah, so I think then the question is, what choice would correspond to Minkowski's, or to some simple linearized, some state that's near to the vacuum?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer. You're going to probably take the free field vacuum, and then you're going to take all, you know, presumably if you go to this complexified thing, you take all the instanton and all their saddles, and you all add them up, and that will correspond to a discrete sum. It's a hard dynamical question to ask. What is the true vacuum? I didn't.
No, but you want to compare after that with observations, right?
Yes.
And there, for instance, in two-dimensional theory, what people, I mean, two-dimensional theory, they sum up overall classical configuration.
Yeah.
And I said for comparison with observation, you have to decompose. So why is there a calculated path integral summing up overall possible instantons or whatsoever? You see, because classical configurations are classical configurations.
Yes,
we have never seen, okay, superposition of two classical configurations. Fortunately, if we are not sure.
Well, I don't know what you mean by support. I mean, I claim there exists in a Hilbert space that of a theory sufficiently general to accommodate tables and chairs and coffee cups. There will exist a state which is a superposition of a table here and there. It's just a very unnatural, it's in some ridiculous corner of your Hilbert space.
No, it's not ridiculous. But I'm sorry. You are getting this kind of states every time when you are making measurement. You see, because you are getting.
No. Now you open this up with the measurement. So I'm not claiming anything about measurement. It's,
I think time for one.
It's fun. Why not?
Can we move on?
I'd underline it again. Suppose you wanted a state that was like a coherent state of a scalar field or electromagnetic field, just, you know.
Yeah. No, I think that's a reasonable thing.
Signal coming through this room.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
would it look
yeah.
in that
so,
description?
So that state would correspond to you would correspond to. And so your coherent state would be some vast number of photons superposed, which sort of produce like a classical background field. And that would be taking an F, which is supported basically on this classical background solution.
But it has to be translated to these other places too somehow.
Yeah, but it will be very sharply peaked around this classical background solution. So there will be negligible contribution. So there is in this picture here, this would be your coherent state, which would be you produce some classical background field to first order approximation, and then your F would be that would correspond to some F, which is reasonably sharply peaked around there.
You said it has to be consistent with parallel transports. There must be such a state like that over every classical background, including other ones that are completely different from the one that we naively have.
Yeah.
That coherent state.
Yeah.
So you have to re-describe that coherent state with respect to all those other backgrounds.
That's right. But there will exist such observables and such state, but if you're really asking me write them down, that's like writing down the non-perturbative vacuum state for QCD. That's just very difficult. But that, I'm just presenting to you a picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so artist impression. Yeah, long hair. So there is a rigorous math. I should say there is a rigorous math behind it, but there are also serious limitations behind it. And the limitations are, of course, that really this is under control only in the sense of formal series in H bar, as it was for Fedosov, as it even is in the final dimension. Mm-hmm. So, but within the sector, the renormalization, that's taken care of. But this sort of more complicated issue, this is no better than the other, the usual perturbation series.
Okay. Thanks, Stefan, again.